But I think it's important before they do, if they do, to remember what they are, what he is dealing with, what will happen to the evidence. Jack Smith is apparently wrapping up. And for that, again, a global audience, who is Jack Smith? What are these two federal cases that he's dealing with? Then we'll talk about the state cases.
So Jack Smith is a longtime federal prosecutor who was appointed as special counsel to handle two investigations of Donald Trump. One of them was into misuse and mishandling of classified information, sort of very serious abuses of information that is crucial to America's national security that Trump appears to have kind of left around at Mar-a-Lago, where it was incredibly vulnerable, and to have hidden from the federal government. And the other investigation is an investigation into Donald Trump's role in efforts to keep him in power after losing the 2020 election and to overturn the results of that election, including inciting a violent insurrection. So these are about as serious a set of offenses for a democracy as you can imagine. Trying to keep yourself in power after you lose an election really cuts at the heart of a democracy. These are not trivial investigations. They are not politically motivated investigations. They're deeply important investigations to America. What appears to be happening is that Jack Smith recognizes that the Department of Justice has a policy that says that a sitting president, that the Department of Justice will not prosecute a sitting president. I think we've always questioned whether that is a legally correct interpretation. It's certainly even less clear that it applies to an investigation, to investigations like these ones that began before Donald Trump's coming term for president. But that is the Department of Justice's policy. I think Jack Smith looks at that and says, these are going to be impossible to bring anyway. And he looks at that further and says that if he stays, he and his team are likely to be fired, could go beyond that. They could be investigated, which could cause a crisis. And if he dismisses those cases, closes down the investigation, as he may be seeing it, that could get you to the same place without the crisis, and is potentially a way to protect his team. But it does mean that these deeply, deeply serious investigations could have the plug pulled on them, which is deeply troubling for democracy. I will say that Jack Smith can, I believe should, and I believe will release a report before he goes, setting out the findings of these investigations and getting that information to the people of the United States.
It will be public?
He doesn't have to do that. He may not do that, but I think that he will. It's certainly what Special Counsel Mueller did in the case that he investigated. It's pretty standard practice. And I have to imagine that Jack Smith's team is hard at work on a public report now that they understand that these cases are very unlikely to make it to trial.
So we haven't even talked about the Mar-a-Lago documents yet, or I should say the White House or the government documents that he brought to Mar-a-Lago. But what about the insurrectionists, the hundreds and hundreds of people who are jailed right now, and what you think Donald Trump will do, who bills himself as the law and order president, but more than 100 police officers were injured? A number died. Some took their own lives. One had an attack the day after he dealt with the gas.
This is, these are not people who are being prosecuted for protesting. They're not the subject of political prosecutions. These are people who are being prosecuted for, in most cases, violent offenses, including assaulting police officers. It's exactly the kind of conduct that law and order politicians tend to abhor, right? Attacking police officers. And yet, Donald Trump has said that he intends to pardon at least some of these people. I think that would be would send a deeply destructive message to the democracy that you can try to overturn an election, try to install someone in power who wasn't elected, and that would be okay, and you can come out just fine. I think that would be a very dangerous message to send. I think, you know, as I was saying before with the Matt Gaetz nomination, I think we can't be shocked if Donald Trump does the things that he has said he was going to do. I think people tend to discount a lot of what he says. I certainly expect that that there's a good possibility that he will do what he said he was going to do, that he will pardon some of these people. And you'll see essentially violent criminals who assaulted law enforcement being set free because they happen to agree with Donald Trump politically. And I think that if that is what occurs, that would be a dangerous day for our democracy.
Two last quick questions, and we have less than a minute. One is what happens with the document case. Aileen Cooper Cannon got rid of it. There's the talk of possibly he would nominate her to the Supreme Court, which goes to also the recess appointments. This whole issue of what that means, how you get people like Matt Gaetz through when perhaps the Senate wouldn't even approve him.
I think it's hard to see how that case comes back at this point where Jack Smith is talking about winding cases down. I think that's deeply unfortunate. It's a very clear case with real national security implications, but it's hard to see a path forward. Recess appointments. Look, we're in a situation where Donald Trump is looking to take unprecedented executive power. There are fewer and fewer checks on that power with a Congress that seems compliant and a Supreme Court that seems compliant. Senate confirmation of nominees is one of the few checks we have left. And if he seeks to subvert that by making large-scale recess appointments, that's one fewer check on his power.
And how does he get the power to do that? What does that mean? He just says Matt Gaetz is the attorney general?
Well, there is a provision in law that says essentially when Congress goes into recess, there is an ability to name officials for a limited period of time, because historically you had situations where there was an emergency need for officials. Congress couldn't get to town as quickly. It is something that traditionally has not been used in large amounts. And, you know, this would be unprecedented. It is also for a limited period of time. And so it would then be up to the courts and to Congress to hold the administration to those limits and make sure that even if Donald Trump abuses this power, it's only temporary, and Senate confirmation is put into play as it legally needs to be.
Enough, let's say it was a year, time enough to destroy documents and also to investigate people that Donald Trump calls the enemy within.
That's right. It's a deeply, deeply dangerous and troubling concept. And I hope the Senate will make it clear that they're not going to tolerate that, with Trump loyalists dominating his party. I'm not entirely confident that will happen, but I certainly hope so.
Noah Buchbinder, president of the D.C. watchdog nonprofit CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He formerly was a Department of Justice lawyer. Coming up, we go to Gaza, as a special U.N. committee says Israel's actions are consistent with the characteristics of genocide. Back in 20 seconds. Billy Joy by Lou Donaldson. The famed saxophonist passed away November 9th at the age of 98. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to Israel's war on Gaza. A special UN committee reported today Israel's action in Gaza are consistent with the characteristics of genocide, unquote. Another report by Human Rights Watch finds Israel's committed war crimes and crimes against humanity through its mass forced displacement of Gaza's civilians. This comes as the Biden administration's decided to continue arming Israel, even though aid groups say Israel's failed to meet a U.S.-imposed 30-day deadline to increase the flow of food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. We go now to Deir al-Balah in Gaza, where we're joined by Arwa Damon, founder of Anara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Previously spent 18 years at CNN, including time as a senior international correspondent. Thanks so much for being with us, Arwa. This is your fourth trip back to Gaza since October 7, 2023. Tell us what you see there.
You know, Amy, you think you can't get worse, and then it does. You think people, quite simply, could never cope with these deteriorating conditions, and yet somehow they do. It's a situation that they have been forced into. Arguably, the conditions when it comes to access of humanitarian organizations and our ability to distribute aid actually getting into the strip, we're talking about the lowest levels yet. And this is exactly during the time frame that the U.S. had given to Israel to actually improve the situation. We've seen it getting significantly worse. We're not just talking about a shortage in things like flour, food, water, fresh vegetables, you know, hygiene kits. We're also talking about shortages in what's available on the commercial market. So even if you somehow had money to be able to go buy what you need, it quite simply isn't here. These hospitals that we keep talking about as being partially functioning, what does that actually mean? It means that if you show up bleeding, someone inside is going to try to stop the bleed, but do they actually have what they need to save your life? No. I was inside visiting some kids here at Aqsa earlier today and over the weekend. There's a little two-year-old boy here whose brain you can see pulsing through his skin. His skull bone was removed. This little boy was not stabilizing properly because the ICU was missing a pediatric-sized tracheostomy tube. Now, luckily, we were able to, you know, source some of them, and he has now stabilized, and he is off the ventilator. But this really gives you an idea of just how serious the situation here is. People are gathering to demonstrate for things like flour, for bread, for whatever it is that you can imagine. Winter is coming. The rains are coming. This means flooding is coming. And on top of just, you know, water flooding, we're also anticipating that the sewage sites are going to be flooding as well. Aid organizations need to be able to have the capacity and the ability to, you know, shift those sites to areas where they're not going to pose even more of a health hazard to the community. So, I mean, it's a complete and total nightmare. It's beyond being a nightmare.
If you can talk about this latest report, the special UN committee says Israel's action in Gaza are consistent with the characteristics of genocide, coming at the same time as a Human Rights Watch report. And UNRWA talks about famine and being imminent in northern Gaza.
If we're talking specifically about the north, the northern province of Gaza, this is an area where, you know, Israel launched its military operation there nearly 4 weeks ago. We have seen people repeatedly being forcibly displaced from their homes. There is very little access to medical assistance there. There has been absolutely no humanitarian assistance delivered there for about the last month. People are starving, they're dying, and it's not just bombs that are killing people, it's also disease. So when we look at the nature of what is happening in Gaza, you can't spend a day here, Amy, and not come away with the notion that you are witnessing a population that is being slowly exterminated. And I say slowly because, yes, bombs kill quickly, but disease and starvation, they are slow killers. And that is what a lot of people are facing here. And talk to anybody in Gaza, and there's absolutely no doubt in their mind that, one, they are living through their own annihilation, and two, what Israel is doing in the northern part is going to be repeated elsewhere. And this is also part of why you see a reluctance among the population to want to evacuate, because Gazans know, Palestinians know that when they leave, they're not going to be able to go back home. This is what history has taught them. And there is this very real ingrained fear among the population here right now that what they're going through at this moment is not the end. There is actually a real sense that the worst is yet to come. And they feel completely and totally abandoned by the international community, by global leaders, not to mention the United States. And everyone is convinced that right now Israel is going to have even more free rein to do whatever it is that it wants here. When you talk to people about what it is that they're going through, they do feel as if every single aspect of trying to survive here has been carefully orchestrated by Israel so that it is able to sort of meet America's bare minimum of standards, to allow America sufficient cover to say, oh no, there's improvement that's happening, and yet actually at the core of it is just another way to continue to kill the population.
And as you talk about the United States, which has given tens of billions of dollars in military aid to Israel, they did recently set a 30-day deadline to increase the flow of food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But the U.S. has decided to keep arming Israel despite this and despite the number of officials in the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government who have quit over this.
Yeah, and let's just look at the numbers. Let's just look at what happened when the U.S. started the clock for that 30-day deadline to improve humanitarian assistance. We saw very shortly afterwards the number of trucks accessing Gaza dipped significantly, down to 30 a day, keeping in mind that one of the key demands that the U.S. had was that aid be increased to at least 350 trucks. So we saw this, you know, decrease consistent of roughly 30 trucks a day for most of the month of October. Now, in November, that number did go up to around 60, 70, but we're still talking about, you know, falling extraordinarily short, providing, you know, barely 20% of what it is that the population here needs. We saw less access to these besieged areas in the north where people are effectively trapped or having to basically risk their lives. We've had numerous instances where aid has been delivered to the Kamar Redwan Hospital in the north, for example, where shortly after medical evacuation teams have arrived there, there have been strikes. You have this very ingrained fear that exists among people right now, especially in the north, where some of them are saying, you know, don't deliver anything because right after you're delivering, strikes are happening. And just to illustrate how it is that we try to move, so if we're moving from, you know, south to north, for example, or even if we're moving within the northern areas, those movement requests have to be approved by Israel. And aid organizations are increasingly wary of moving around with what we call soft skin cars, which is basically your normal vehicle that we used to move around in, because of the increasing frequency of instances at Israeli checkpoints where aid convoys have been shot at by IDF troops after receiving the green light, the okay to cross through, which means that for a lot of aid organizations, movement is limited to those who have access to armored vehicles. Vehicles that are more secure. And those don't really exist in Gaza in high numbers at all. And we're not allowed to bring in more to sort of beef up our capacity to be able to move around safely. I mean, no matter which way you look at it, Amy, you're constantly faced by numerous obstacles that don't need to be there. It feels very deliberate, not to mention the complete and total breakdown of security. Now we have numerous looting instances of aid trucks. We've repeatedly asked the Israeli side to be able to use alternative routes, to be able to use secured routes. Those requests are not being met. I mean, it's just, it's such an impossible situation to operate in. I feel like I keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. each time I come in. And the words to demonstrate how much worse it's getting quite simply lack in our vocabulary.
Mm. You also wrote a piece recently, The Devastation of Lebanon, for New Lines. And we have this headline, The Washington Post reporting close aide to Netanyahu told Donald Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that Israel's rushing to advance a ceasefire deal in Lebanon is a gift to Trump ahead of his January inauguration. Your response to the significance of Trump's election and what it means to the people of Lebanon and Gaza?
You know, first of all, anyone who lives in the Middle East and anyone who's kind of been focusing on the Middle East knows very well that it really doesn't matter who's in the White House, whether it's Republican or Democrat. That really is not going to change significantly U.S. policy towards this region. But the thing that we've been hearing, specifically when it comes to the re-election of Donald Trump, is at least he's not lying to us. At least whatever America is going to let Israel do, it's going to be done faster. So if our end is coming, at least it's going to come faster. Whereas when it comes to, you know, specifically the Biden administration, the sense is that the Democrats are far more willing to allow this slower, more painful death. But the end result, no matter who it is, people are fully convinced, is exactly the same. And all people really want right now is for this to end. People are suffocated. They're crushed. They cannot keep going like this. And they very much feel as if, you know, no matter what it is, no matter who it is, Arabs are viewed by the United States and by the Western world as somehow being less than. Their lives are not that valuable. You constantly hear people in Gaza, and we were hearing the same thing in Lebanon, making comments like, well, you know, America, it doesn't care if we live or die. It doesn't care how much we suffer. Our lives don't matter to them. And that is not really a perspective that changes all that much, no matter who is sitting in Washington.
We just have 30 seconds, Arwa. Why did you give up journalism for humanitarian work? What do you think you can accomplish at Inara that you couldn't do as a journalist?
There's a certain sort of privilege of being able to spend extensive periods of time with people and really get to know who they are. And I feel as if, you know, moving around in the humanitarian sphere, I'm getting a different understanding of sort of people's emotional journeys, what it actually takes to be able to provide them with assistance. And it's provided me a different way of being able to continue to sort of share people's stories and experiences, but also be able to immediately at least try to provide assistance. You know, the challenge that we have when we're out in the field as journalists is that you don't always see the impact. But when you're in the humanitarian space, there's a certain kind of magic when you're able to just bring a smile to a child's face. And I needed that.
Arwa Damon, we thank you so much for being with us. Stay safe. Award-winning journalist, was with CNN for 18 years, but now has founded Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Speaking to us from Deir al-Balah in Gaza, outside Al-Aqsa Hospital. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal jury in Virginia has ordered the U.S. military contractor CACI to pay $42 million to three Iraqi men who were tortured at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The landmark verdict came after 16 years of litigation, the first time a civilian contractor has been found legally responsible for the gruesome abuses at Abu Ghraib, which included murder, sexual assault, rape, the use of attack dogs, sleep deprivation, prolonged isolation, dietary manipulation, induced hypothermia, mock executions, and the humiliation of prisoners. We're joined right now by Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented the Abu Ghraib plaintiffs. In these last few minutes we have, Bahar, talk about what actually this lawsuit has been about and who wins this multimillion-dollar settlement.
Yeah, this lawsuit has been about justice and accountability for three Iraqi men, our clients, Salah, Suhail, and Assad, who exhibited, I think, just awe-inspiring courage and resilience to fight for 16 years and get over every innumerable hurdle khaki threw in its way to deflect responsibility, to have their voice heard by a jury. And as you said, it's also the first time a jury has ever had really the opportunity to review and judge U.S. practices, in this case, by a private military contractor. In the 20 years since 9/11, and despite the horrific number of abuses inflicted on many, many dozens of other torture victims.
I mean, Blackwater is a military contractor, very well known. Explain what CACI, or now known as CACI, mm-hmm. did.
Yeah, so
when was it?
In 2003, CACI was hired by the United States government under a lucrative contractor to provide, quote, expert interrogators in Abu Ghraib, and they sent a number of highly unqualified individuals. The two qualified people who were there actually were whistleblowers and told CACI that they were seeing abuses there and needed to leave. And then, as it turned out, in the kind of command vacuum that persisted in Abu Ghraib, it was the CACI interrogators who took control and ordered military police, including military police who were court-martialed and spent time in prison for the very abuses CACI ordered them to undertake, to, quote, soften up detainees, set the conditions, particularly in the night shift. And all our clients suffered the kinds of abuses you regrettably showed on the screen.
So the photos of Abu Ghraib that shock the world, naked prisoners with bags over their heads, piled on top of each other in a human pyramid, as an American soldier, Sabrina Harmon, grins behind them. Her colleague, Charles Grainer, can be seen smiling, giving a thumbs up. Interestingly, Sabrina Harmon testified on behalf of the plaintiffs and broke down on the stand.
Yeah, it was really remarkable and transformative testimony, because she's one of the co-conspirators who was taking direction from military intelligence, including CACI, to harm detainees. And she's somebody who expressed, like a lot of the MPs, just was broken by this experience. And what came out in the trial is military generals who investigated Abu Ghraib and documented sadistic, wanton, systemic abuses were outraged. The military police who were part of the CACI scheme were broken. And the only person who has never taken responsibility, CACI, until now.
I want to go to end with one of the plaintiffs, Salah al-Ejjali, who was on Democracy Now! A decade ago. He talked about his time in solitary confinement at Abu Ghraib.
يعني قضايا التحقيق كانت التحقيق التي كانت تحدث كل يومين أو ثلاثة أيام يستمر التحقيق لساعة ساعة ونص.
These interrogations that happened every two or three days would last for an hour and a half or 2 hours in this manner. The details of the interrogations were different. In some cases they would bring dogs, then start the interrogation. In other cases they'd put you in a place and throw cold water or hot tea on you, then start the interrogation. But of course all the interrogations were conducted while you were kept naked and hooded, and they'd ask you questions to which you answer. I stayed for 40 days in a solitary cell, and 70% of that time I was kept naked.
That's Abu Ghraib prisoner Salah al-Ejjali. He is now lives in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. He now lives in Sweden, yeah. And just to clarify, the jury awarded each of the plaintiffs $3 million in compensatory damages and $33 million in punitive damages, because they saw right through CACI's deflection and finally held them responsible for the egregious and reckless conduct the jury found they engaged in. So it is a small victory in the context of broader human rights efforts in the global war on terrorism that so many people have been involved in over the 20 years, but it's still significant.
Bahar Azmi, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
On average, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. The women in our communities deserve to feel safe from both emotional and physical abuse. They deserve men who control their anger. Most importantly, they deserve to know the people they love most will never hurt them. Men like me stand up to create a safer world for the women